Right. So, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here today for this crucial conversation on femicide, the gender-based killing of women and girls organized by the Hellenic Observatory at the LSE. I'm Irini Moustaki, a professor in the Department of Statistics at the LSE and a research affiliate at the Hellenic Observatory. Femicides are not isolated tragedies. They are part of a global crisis fueled by gender-based violence, structural inequalities, and cultural norms that enable impunity. Every day, countless women lose their lives at the hands of intimate partners, family members, and strangers simply because they are women. This is a topic which is hard to talk about, but is necessary in order to reveal the violence against women, understand the reasons behind it, and how to bring a change. Our four panelists will give different insights based on their research projects, expertise, and experiences. Violence against women is underreporting. At the same time, the reported cases lack important information, showing a lack of interest in collecting and documenting the crimes. Professor Kodri's paper titled With Miles, Who Counts? The Invisibility of Mothers as Victims of Femicide tells us the whole story. As put by Catherine D'Ignazio and Coren Klein in their book on data feminism, the collection of data is compromised by imbalances of power. And they go ahead to say who is collecting, storing, and analyzing data, and whose data are collected, stored, and analyzed. As statisticians will also tell us, you cannot change something unless you can measure it. One of the significant issues in studying those crimes is data scarcity. In her work, Mimi Onuaha, a Nigerian-American visual artist and academic, in her project on the Library of Missing Datasets, has explored the idea of missing data, which she describes as blank holes in otherwise data-saturated systems. The missing data or incomplete data on femicides has led to individual women's efforts I'm very sorry. I just lost the connection, I think. It's another example of documenting and raising awareness about femicides in Greece. It all boils down to what noted in the Data Feminism book, what gets counted counts, what is not counted. Oh, I'm very sorry. It's the LSE. It's the LSE network. Yeah, stays invisible. So I will just say this again. What gets counted, what is not counted stays invisible. I'm very sorry. I didn't anticipate. Okay, anyway, I'll start without the video. So let me now introduce our panelists. We're very honored to have today's lineup of speakers. Lily Kouliaraki is professor in media and communications at LSE and coordinator of the Society Identity and Rights Research Cluster at the Hellenic Observatory. Her research focuses on the mediation of human vulnerability, witnessing ethics, and victimhood cultural politics. She's the author of many books, including the recent one titled Wrong, The Weaponization of Victimhood, on the strategic uses of the victim in the communication of far-right actors in Western public spheres. Rachel Kodri is a professor of criminology at Oxford University. Her work focuses on the intersections between crime and the family, which has included research projects on the families of serious offenders, prisoners' families, parenting in youth justice, and filial violence, which is violence and abuse from children, adolescents, and adult-aged children towards their parents. Rachel currently directs the Filial Violence Project and the Global Prisoners' Families Group. Aphrodite Koulaksi is an LSE fellow and a research affiliate at the Hellenic Observatory. Her research explores identity and migration at the intersection of sociology, urban studies, media, and communications. We look forward to her forthcoming monograph, Citizenship in Crisis in Athens: Migration, Media, and Identity. Last but not least, Maria Liapi is a sociologist, researcher, and member of the steering committee of the OTIMA, a women's nonprofit organization specializing in gender inequality issues, and she has participated in Greek and EU research projects to promote gender equality. Our panelists will speak for 20 minutes each, starting with Mrs. Liapi, then Professor Kouliaraki and Dr. Koulaksi, and the third contribution will be by Professor Kodri. Bit of housekeeping announcements before I lose the connection again. For those Twitter X users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEGreece. This event is being recorded and hopefully will be made available as a podcast and video subject to no technical difficulties. I can already see many difficulties. And if you wish to ask a question at the event today, please the Q&A session, use the Q&A function, state your name and affiliation ahead of your question and your location.
Apologies, everybody. This is the LSE IT system that usually confronts us with this kind of nerve-wracking moments. I hope...
Yes, sorry, Lily. I quickly changed my computer to the iPad. Sorry, Lily, the floor is yours. Sorry. We'll start with Mrs. Liapi.
Yeah. Okay. Hi, everybody. Thank you for this invitation to this very interesting subject matter. And I will try to contribute from my experience and the work of Teotima in the field for some decades now. And meaning that we actually support and we service females and femininities that they are survivors, and we provide with psychosocial support and legal and free legal aid, empowerment and other activities, as well as research on the issue. I was asked to make a presentation of the legal and policy context in Greece regarding GBV and femicides. So in the light of recent femicides in Greece, especially after the ratification of the Istanbul Convention in 2018, there is a need to reconsider the means to prevent and combat violence against women, hereafter in GBV. A major problem in this field is the insufficient collecting of statistical data, as it was already said by Lily, and the inadequate monitoring of qualitative and quantitative data by the competent authorities in Greece. Therefore, there is no real and accurate picture of percentages, trends, reasons, incentives, etc. over the years. According to Diotima's records, we have noticed that data for the years 2020 to 2024, based on the sexual harassment map and grassroots organization in the Greek department of the European Observatory on Femicide, the number recorded is 226 versus 173 appeared in the police records. That is, 36 femicides are not recorded, not to mention that for many of them, we do not even know their names. Indicatively, are not recorded femicides that are not committed by non-partners, as was the case with Topaludi and Susan Eaton, and femicides of trans women, as Anna, with Anna Ivankova, or those or refugees, Fahima Ahmadi and her two daughters that were killed in Evros, and many others. Also, great number of the victims are over 60, and some of murderers committed suicide afterwards, which is a pattern for the Greek case, according to Athena Peglidou. Lack of data are only indicative of the demographics of the killed women, which eventually do not provide basis for targeted and diversified prevention, response, and support policies, and of course, comparisons through time and region or countries. This situation reveals not only lack of recording, but more importantly, the biases, racialization, ageism, and otherness of the victim by the state. GBV is at the same time racial and based on class, as the two systems of oppression are interconnected. On the basis of the data from the site femicide.gr for the years 2022, for 4 years, we can briefly discuss some qualitative data just to give a picture. The relation between murderer and victim, the great majority refer to femicides which are committed in domestic, familiar, or intimate partner relations. Previous exercise of physical violence by the murderer, which is very important. In six cases, 29%, previous physical abuse by the husband against the victim was already known by the police, which points to the responsibilities of the protection services. Only in one case for the data of the 2020 public data, past incidents of assault is recorded. Given that femicide is in many cases the end of the continuum of exerted violence, this is very important information to be ignored. The place and the scene of femicides, 22 in the house of the couple, 9 in another house of the victim or the perpetrator, and 4 of them that were committed outdoor. The region, most of the femicides for that period were committed not in urban cities, but mostly in the periphery, in the province and small towns of the country. As regards the age of the victims, it's a great range, but most of cases on marital ages, 26 to 46. And this, of course, it has to do also that it is mostly recorded the domestic violence. So it is these ages are represented in this, let's say, context. Age of murderers, the average is 41 to 53 years of age. Coming now to the legal framework of femicides as in Greece, the crime of homicide, is treated as gender neutral by the Greek law. Homicide by intent is punishable with a life sentence. In practice, however, in many cases, this sentence is reduced due to mitigating circumstances recognized by the court. As for the proposal of the legal establishment of the term femicide, which is Diotima's position as well, the objections are as follows. The deniers accept that the term has a place in everyday language and in criminology. However, that the penal code is not a dictionary. Its terminology must be as simple as possible, and the words man, human, have an equal weight for every assassination fitting for every homicide. One different term could lead to a discriminatory treatment, and this, when applied, could result to an unjust punishment or an unjust acquittal. They also believe, incorrectly, that feminists and other legal professionals are asking for the legal recognition because, allegedly, we want heavier sentences while the punishment for all homicides by intent is life imprisonment. Both arguments are false. Because by calling the killing of a woman because she's a woman femicide, we will be able to demonstrate the structural elements of violence, the imbalance of power, the continuum of violence, which will enable the court to impose not a heavier punishment, but a proportionate one, and the state to create effective prevention policies. The killing of the ecumenical human being, as Papanagiotou says, is unable to protect women, femininities, and unconventional off-centered masculinities. Also, as Professor Maropoulou pointed, it is demanded a new criminological category, as femicide has something more than remains in the space of unuttered for the just. This which has to be revealed is the fact that in femicide conflate two edges. The extreme penal behavior, the taking of a human being's life, and the extreme lethal form of gender sexist violence. It's a plural violence and is of its conceptual, conceivable context and as of its causes and consequences, as Professor Maropoulou says. In any case, by combining theoretical research with the experience of activism in an exemplary way feminists have demonstrated over the last three decades its analytical and political utility. Femicide has enabled them to effectively challenge the dominant way of understanding a series of violent deaths involving women femininities, and by giving gendered meaning to a subset of homicides to cause cracks in the social order that legitimizes or tolerates these deaths. Since then, its diffusion has led to a fruitful elaboration of a continuous redefinition of its contents, as well as its gradual adoption by international organizations such as the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the European Institute for Gender Equality, and others. We are destined to bring the issue of its definition back to the fore and help to define patriarchal systems of social organization as systems of discourses, which are continuously reproduced socially and linguistically through the action of institutions and people. Finally, the term of femicide is not a neologism, it is a terrain of sociopolitical and transformative potential which disputes the patriarchal structuring of our societies. In the case of civil remedies, there is no guarantee of immediacy in the adoption of protection measures, only in the case is considered flagrant. For most victims, to our knowledge also from the field, the waiting time and the uncertainty regarding the outcome of the procedure, up to 8 months, and for the provisional measures, 1 month to be issued by the court, these represent too much of a safety risk. It is important to mention here that in all of the cases, it is women and their children who have to be removed from the house instead of remaining safe in their own home. Linking protection to places rather than to people, as pointed by Grevio's report, also bears the risk of protection gaps. Consequently, the victim needs to apply for additional civil protection measures for the custody of common children or to request prohibition of contact of the surrender of any weapons. Civil proceedings in Greece entail court and lawyers' fees. For 2020, protection orders were issued only in respect of around 1% of the prosecuted perpetrators of domestic violence. Although beneficiaries of free legal aid are exempted from court fees, this is an ad hoc measure and is addressing only very, very, very poor women and is inefficient. Efficiently implemented, sorry, and the cost of applying for civil protection measure can act as a deterrent for many women to be qualified for legal aid. Equally important is that protection orders are frequently breached by perpetrators. Nonetheless, no information is available on the number and type of sanctions imposed in instances of such breaches, again by Grevio's report. Coming now to the last law reform voted on 29th of January this year, last year, sorry, it utilizes criminal repression this year, right? Criminal repression and stricter penalties as the main, if not exclusive, way to protect victims of gender-based violence. It is characterized by a punitive logic, ignoring the fact that addressing the phenomenon requires understanding its social causes and intervening in order to tackle them. It places no particular emphasis on holistic and long-term policies to prevent and combat GBV. Moreover, as Andrew Diotim, along with radical feminist organizations, very few indeed, and the relevant scientific and professional agencies of the country have stated during the hearing of CSOs in the parliament, the principle of proportionality and the presumption of innocence are violated, while a number of provisions of the new law contradict the Constitution of the European Convention on Human Rights. In a word, as feminists, or should be very critical to the phenomenon of penal populism coming in an era of anti-gender, alt-right rhetoric and politics regarding anti-abolitionist ideas. The cornerstone is, of course, the recent case with Kyriaki Griva, who was murdered in front of the police station and in front of the eyes of the police guards when she went to denounce her harasser. Accessibility to police stations to ask for help is even worse when it comes to migrant and refugee women residing in the country due to lack of formal interpretation available, and in some other cases, As has been reported to us, they are infantilized by the police officers. Gender, therefore, we can see that intersects with income, education, race, sexuality in diverse economic, social, and cultural contexts. It's time we substantiate gender and therefore its relation to gender-based values. It's about intersection of power, gender, and GBV. In contrast to three common sense individualized approach, performativity, as Butler has told us, help us to comprehend GBV and therefore femicide as both result and cause of violence. Hegemonic males use violence to counterbalance the fact that they feel to be inferior of the genderized male ideal. The life and the stories of the victims consist a comprehensive and lethal microworld of institutional negligence, state indifference, economic and social precarity, cultural marginalization. It is in this political and ideological context that Latin American feminists have introduced the term feminicidio. We can later on discuss if asked. The femicides in the media now. Regarding practices of discourse used in news, adoption not only of the media but the police and the society about hegemonic male violence as thinkable, conceivable, natural and normal condition of current culture is easily evidenced. The political results of the media representation and narration strengthen heteronormativity and the reproduction of gender myths and in parallel accustom public audiences in violence and making femicides thinkable and more or less normalized. Moreover, media practices contribute to the reconstruction of specific subjectivities, their categorization and classification, the unhappy woman victim, the foreign and the local dead, the monster murderer and the normal man, etc. These subjectivities are protagonists in dramas, thrillers, and family tragedies, which are the creation of journalistic and media narrations. These result in their isolation, perceived as rare and extreme incidents in what we call social exoticism. There is silence about key issues of gender-based violence. The actual context is unexplained, and what is underlined are cliches like honor and honor crimes or the sexuality and conduct of the victim. The vocabulary and in general the language used in media depictions is also highly problematic, stereotypical, heteronormative, as I said, and control-based notions of love, misreasoning, and characterizations of victim survivors as unlucky. Verbal abuse can be present in reporting that lectures or incites judgments, which in turn are used to characterize women, LGBTQ, or young people only referencing to heterosexual men and or macho identities. Headings, titles of articles and of news items in general may be sensationalized in order to attract the audience. The use of music and other props, as well as use of hidden cameras and undercover methods also contribute to the sensationalization of the subject matter, whose resilience and agency are more than often intentionally disregarded or ignored, since the notion of the victim becomes an everlasting identity. Stereotypes, voyeurism has dear consequences for both the victims and society in general. There is no detailed knowledge of the problem in the media sector, and there are no expert journalists who may be consulted. Therefore, often the media turn to members of the celebrity culture to be consulted, which leads to the use of forced conclusions about relevant data, makes for sensational or simplistic conclusions and headlines. According to Michalakeli, 2022, the biased reporting of gender violence in the media is evident in the following features. First of all, the claim for the so-called objective presentation of facts, despite the sensualized content, including unnecessary and disturbing details of the crime. Secondly, as something that happens to people who are different to us. Therefore, sexism, racism, homo, transphobia, and bias towards minorities render it possible for the audience to feel untouched by this type of violence. Also, the media depiction of the victim as promiscuous and therefore responsible for what happened to them, i.e. victim blaming, which renders perpetrators irresponsible, e.g. through the use of phrases such as crime of passion and family tragedy, which is often interrelated to reports about the shock of the society for the perpetrator, who up to then was never considered a victimizer, not taking into account any indication of previous violent acts on his part. Another point raised by Michalakelis is the fact that the media reproduced the idea that gender-based violence is a private issue and therefore local communities cannot and should not interfere. Anna Vujukas makes reference to Gardi and Guizot, who recognize three mechanisms that the media activate by their objectification of women: a cognitive, an emotional, and a normative mechanism. The cognitive mechanism causes a dehumanization of the objectified, the emotional disrupts empathic resonance, and thirdly, the normative mechanism shifts gender norms so that the meaning behind its gender representation is disrupted and modified. Gardi and Guizot highlight also the objectification that diminishes women to their bodies, presuming that their existence as citizens is secondary to their appearance and attractiveness to men. According to Kyriakidou, not aiming to highlight political responsibility and expose how the abuse of power allowed and led to the tolerance of gender-based violence, disempowers survivors and the dynamic of the growing protest and resistance of the feminist movement. Avramopoulou examines what exactly consists a piece of news. What knowledge is the news transmitting, and how do we learn something we already know, and the consequences of the repeatability of this knowledge? Also, how gender-based violence seems inconceivable and at the same time commonplace. What really matters is the individualized experience of a heterosexual, white, and vulnerable femininity, subjectivity, which as a victim asks for justice or vindication. Michalakia discussed the phenomenon of TV trials, along with the theatralization of penal cases by journalistic discourse, disregarding deontology about lawsuit documents, put up virtual courtrooms with the host of the show taking the role of the judge, often in the presence of lawyers, through this, which is unethical. This practice familiarizes the public with peephole journalism, as he called it, investing every incident with a double cozy pornographic gaze of the media and of the public. This gossip continuously reproducing details is a discourse which creates moral panic based on simplified forms and caricatures. Finally, Psilaku talks about major spectacle and asks us to reinvent what it means to make something public and be ready to create a new world. Last but not least, the media rarely focus on a journalism that would be beneficial to the victims with valuable information. Rather, the crime is presented as the end of the story, making it seem as though it is inevitable or inescapable. The public slogan, order, it was in a campaign to break the silence, calling the women who have been subjected to violence, may reproduce precisely the silencing of the very phenomenon it is supposed to highlight. And in a final part, and I'm completing, the broader sociocultural and political context of Greek society. In Greek society in particular, the family is perhaps the most basic social value. According to gender stereotypes, the ideal role of women is the household, while that of men is to bring the money home. This is a possibility of dominance provided by patriarchal systems to men, but it does not always signal an attempt to maintain patriarchal power, but often it signals the lost power of men in systems whose social identities cannot be realized without the use of this power. During the transmission of news, by linking the behaviors of subjects with various values and categories, is a process to what Lito Seliti and Sunderland call moral argumentation, leading to perceptions of right and wrong that constitute shared knowledge among people, portray femicide as crimes without emphasizing the gender characteristics of murder. As I try to discuss, femicides do not happen in a sociocultural and political vacuum. Therefore, it is important to examine the many examples of sexism and the rape culture in news titles, openly or latently, which is reproduced in the media, mass media, and social media, everyday discussions, lyrics of songs, books, on TV, the cinema, in the art, in the schools, in workplaces, in the family. The study of the femicides in relation to the body, biopolitics, death politics or necropolitics, and the mourning as resistance is of a great importance, but beyond such presentation. Only a brief reference here that due to the struggles and the publicity, parents of Eleni Topaloudi and later on of some other victim mothers, together with the feminist LGBTQ protests and demonstrations for the murder of Jackie Oza Kostopoulos, femicides gained greater visibility and, most importantly, in its intersectionality. Femicide is a phenomenon which does not start and ends with the murderer. Instead, we cannot omit to investigate state actors, police, penal courts, statistical institutions, etc., and the sociocultural patriarchal which ignore daily gender oppressions which are considered as no social problem and find no place in the media. The media exerts symbolic violence. I have
you have maybe one more minute. Sorry.
One more minute, okay, just to conclude, okay.
Yes.
The media exerts symbolic violence against women as a kind of a secondary killing. The lack of dignified, respectful treatment of their life stories is of great importance, since according to Russell and Kelly, GBV has as consequence not only the result of the death of the victim, but also dictates the lifelong condition of fear of its probable appearance in every single woman's life. I would like to end with okay, I will stop here just to read the Jane Caputi in 1978 slogan: all instances of sexual terror serve as lessons for all women. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Ms. Leopoldi. Thank you. So I think there will be time in the discussion, you know, to bring more of your points. So the next contributors are Professor Lily Kouliaraki and Dr. Aphrodite Koulaxi. So I think Aphrodite will start first.
Thank you, Irini. And good evening, everyone. From my side as well. It's an honor to be here today to introduce a research project on the mediation of femicides in Greece. So this is a collaborative study still in its early stages, funded by the LSE Hellenic Observatory, and includes Lily Kouliaraki, Adonis Dimitriadis, Irini Moustaki, and myself. So every day, 137 women are murdered in the world, one every 10 minutes. And these are not just numbers, so these are women with names, stories, and dreams cut short. Yet how we see and understand these events is shaped by the media, by the ways femicide is reported, framed, and sometimes even justified. In the past 4 years, Greece has witnessed 110 reported femicide, according to the Greek Observatory for Femicides, a number that underscores the enduring urgency of gender-based violence in this society. And this despite the rise of the Me Too movement in Greece in 2021, which marked a significant moment in public conversations, with the term femicide gaining prominence in certain media outlets. In this project, we define femicide as the infliction of lethal violence on women on the grounds that they are women, a paraphrase from Diane Russell and Jill Radford's definition. The mediation of femicide, in turn, is a form of mediation that places the roles of victims and perpetrators at the center of the news narrative in ways that reflect patriarchal norms about the social roles of men and women. There is already a large body of existing literature, both on Greece and globally, which draws attention precisely to these roles of victims and perpetrators in femicide news. And while we found this literature indispensable in developing our research design, our own contribution has a different remit. Specifically, existing literature examines how these narrative roles in the news present women as passive, pitiful victims, or even as responsible for their own deaths, for example, through victim blaming. While they often provide psychological explanations and justifications for the violence of male perpetrators, thus encouraging empathetic emotions towards men who kill women. And these patterns were also corroborated by our own preliminary content analysis on Greek femicide news. Our focus today goes beyond these well-established news tropes and draws attention to specifically female victims and how news narratives establish an internal hierarchy among women victims in the reporting of femicides, namely how news narratives give prominence to some victims so that we remember their names for years to come, while some never acquire a name and never become visible or recognized as human beings. Our preliminary narrative analysis of news stories in Greek media concentrates on data from the year 2021, a total of 31 reported femicide cases and 206 articles. As we briefly mentioned, 2021 was the year of the Greek Me Too movement, which was also the year when issues of gender-based violence began acquiring a new prominence in the news and in the discourse around femicides, particularly after the femicide of Caroline Crouch that we'll also discuss during our presentation. And while our project encompasses both quantitative and qualitative dimensions of analysis, we are here focusing exclusively on the qualitative narrative analysis of femicide news. Our interest in narrative variation and the hierarchy of female victims in the news in the project stems from the realization that despite increasing awareness around gender-based violence in Greece, research on how femicides are mediated in the Greek news has slightly overlooked the fact that the category of female victims of femicide is not a homogeneous one, and that female victimhood is differentiated on the basis of the media's implicit patriarchal norms about which types of victims are worth memorializing while others are not. In order to examine how news stories establish such hierarchies of female victimhood, we focus on narrative variation through the lens of news frames, what Edmund in 1993 calls, quote, narrative patterns of selection, emphasis and exclusion in communication that shape how people understand an issue, end of quote. We look, in other words, into how each news story uses language to select what matters in the event of femicide, what needs to be omitted, and how we are invited to understand and evaluate the action and its participants, here particularly the female victim. Firstly, we focus on which news frames are employed across femicide news stories. That is the type of narrative and language is used to define what the issue is and what matters in the story. Secondly, it examines how within its story, these news frames combine and fuse to define its femicide in a different way, as a distinct event, and thus to highlight or de-emphasize different aspects of it, and ultimately to tell us how and why the story matters, and how and why the female victim matters or not. And thirdly, it establishes a typology of news narratives that, depending on their various combinations of news frames, construct femicides within a normative hierarchy of grievable and ungrievable lives, depending on primarily on age, so young, promising women, rather than ethnicity, nationality, disability, sexuality, and other categories. A few more details on the research design. So we zoom into the news stories of the 31 femicides that took place in Greece in the year 2021 across two most established newspapers of right and left-leaning press, Kathimerini and Evsin respectively, for a full week following the event, so a total of 206 stories. We ask, what kind of frames do this trend appear in? How do these frames mix and fuse within its news story? To which effect? In other words, what are the implications of these frames for the construction of the victim? Whose death is acknowledged and whose is overlooked? So specifically, our research identifies five key media frames used in the femicide coverage, each enacting a different mediation of femicides. So firstly, the bureaucratic frame used predominantly in minimal coverage cases. This frame relies on police and forensic reports and employs institutional procedural language. So we know the location, the time, manner of and justification for killing, age and ethnicity of victim and perpetrator. The cinematic frame Common across both right and left leaning media. This frame focuses on crime scene descriptions and perpetrator emotions, evoking fear and pity. The emphasis here falls on details of family relationships, the inclusion of direct dialogue work along with emotive language to enhance visceral effect and graphic descriptions of violence. The witnessing frame, including testimonies from family and friends, encouraging empathetic involvement in her suffering and portraying her as a person. This approach is often used more in left-leaning media and humanizes the victim. The politicized frame, used to refer to political actors and party political debates, with politicians using cases to advance agendas or critique opponents, often rhetorical rather than action-driven. And finally, we have the interventionist frame, used predominantly to encompass activists and left-leaning outlets. This frame demands systemic change, linking femicide to broader gendered violence structures. And here you can see the summary of the five different media frames. And now Lily will introduce the hierarchies of victimhood, depending on the combination of different frames in our analysis.
Thank you, Aphrodite. So while the separation of news frames into five distinct types works as an analytical exercise, mapping, if you like, the kind of regulative structure of the news, in actual practices of mediation, in the real text that we read in the newspapers, these frames do not appear independently of one another, but most of the time they mix and fuse with one another in ways that produce hybrid narratives of victimhood, different emotional orientations towards the victim and the perpetrator, and different moral commitments towards the victim of the femicide. And it is in this mixing and fusing within each news story that these distinct frames construct hierarchies of victimhood. For example, the sole use of a bureaucratic frame, detached and emotionless, can withhold empathy and commitment to the female victim, while a combination of witnessing and interventionist frames can amplify emotional engagement and it can go even beyond that to demand justice. In other words, the ways in which these frames come together and articulate with one another, and therefore the kind of engagements and orientations that they invite on behalf of their media publics, ultimately contribute to shaping who is deemed worthy of empathy and who remains invisible. So, following our narrative analysis of the 206 news reports, in 2021 across Kathimerini and Efimeridaton Sidakton, we ended up clustering our stories within one of three news categories: adventure, emergency, and ecstatic news. And this is a categorization that I first introduced in previous work that I have done on the global mediation of distant suffering in my book, The Spectatorship of Suffering, back in 2006. As we can see in this slide, adventure news is a type of news narrative that provides basic information on the femicide and fails to invite a deeper affective and moral engagement with the event and the victim. And as we can also see on this slide, this comprises 25 cases overall, or 80.65% of all the kind of data sample that we analyzed. Moving on to emergency news, this is a type or a category of news that provides a rich account of the event with multiple temporalities, contexts, and voices, raising the moral and political demand for intervention, for institutional reform. And finally, with ecstatic news, which is the rarest of all three categories of news, we have just two of the cases that we analyzed. And what happens with that particular category is that it transcends the traditional temporality of the news, extending for days or weeks. framing the femicide as exceptional, as a unique event of extraordinary emotional power, in ways that manages to capture the public's attention and full emotional engagement for quite a long time. So if we move on to the to adventure news, here are a few screenshots from characteristic examples of that category of news. I'll translate a couple of those. 50-year-old's death in Chania was murder, and man stabbed grandmother in Kalythea. Now, the adventure news category is the par excellence category of the bureaucratic frame. And you can see here as well, I think that we have 90 stories or 43.69% kind of covering that category. It is really informed by the genre of police news releases. And this category is about anonymous victims, the majority of them middle-aged or elderly, who receive minimal coverage in a procedural and depersonalized language, both about the victim and the perpetrator. And the three semiotic features that kind of make up this category of news is descriptive narratives that only register facts, singular contexts, mentioning briefly location, time, age, and occasionally ethnicity of the victim and perpetrator, and the suppression of the potential for emotional engagement. The female victim of adventure news is thus fully dehumanized, and the femicide event itself is, as I'm going to come back to in the end, decontextualized, that is, devoid of any broader social and cultural context within the femicide took place. Moving on to emergency news, and you can see again the numbers. We have 30 stories of emergency news, or 56% of the total number of stories. These really involve nameless victims, so we don't know the names of these victims, at least not in the time frame that we analyzed the first week. They happened, for those of you who are Greek, many of you will probably remember them, in Makrinitsa, Pelion, in Daphne, Athens, in Rhodini, Rhodes, and Alexandroupolis in Evros. And just to take one example of those, in the case of Daphne, a man brutally murdered his 31-year-old wife and mother of their one child in their flat in this neighborhood of Athens because he was jealous. So some of the headlines actually pointed towards the preventability of the femicide, which is something we don't really see in adventure news. Their neighbor had called the police, Efsin put it, implying police failure, obviously, in intervening on time for the victim to be saved. Or, as Kathmerini says, he killed her after all. And Kathmerini is here quoting the voice of one of the victim's neighbors who tried to intervene by reporting the case of domestic violence to the police in vain, with no subsequent actions. So cases like this that point precisely to those moments where institutions failed women represent a critical shift in the news framing of femicides. So unlike the minimal bureaucratic frame that we saw earlier, this category mixes and fuses all five frames. And that is evident in the hybrid language of the news. For instance, it includes forensic details about the crime, sensationalist descriptions of the crime scene, the victim's position, the perpetrator's escapes and subsequent arrests. There are witnessing accounts, voices, for instance, that speak on behalf of the victim, the family, neighbors, friends, the broader community. But also references to what is being left behind when that woman's life is cut short. Children, parents, people who loved them. And so in this way, these narratives with this kind of a mixture of frames add emotional and biographical depth to femicide victims as individuals. We also have, crucially, as I said earlier, statements from law practitioners, prosecutors, and concerned citizens and activist voices who announce that urgent need that something has to change. So what we have here is really a partial humanization of the victim. It's not a full humanization precisely because of the lack of naming the victim. So none of them, as I said earlier, have been named in these stories. But still, there is the kind of context and the testimonials are there to provide a degree of humanization. The primary focus of such coverage, to wrap this category up, is on the critique of institutional failure or inaction, particularly on behalf of the left-wing press, promoting calls for protests and reactions, responses against those failures in the face of increasing femicides. Moving on to ecstatic news now. Ecstatic news is really the rarest of all three categories. There was really only two cases. We all remember them. It's Caroline Crouch and Garifalia Psaraku. And despite the fact that we have only two cases in the kind of total number of femicides in 2021, in fact, we have 86 stories in the first week about those femicides or 41.75% of our data. Both cases are about young victims with a promising life ahead of them. They are Greek women or women who have lived in Greece and have assimilated or perceived themselves as Greek, either young mothers or university graduates starting their careers following their studies, both involve in some ways a perfect victimhood, so to speak. Youth perceived as blameless or innocent, sympathetic, and credible in the eyes of the public and in the eyes of the legal system. Specifically, the case of Caroline Crouch, who was killed in Glykana in 2021, in May 11, 2021. She was a young mother with an 11-month-old baby. And her case epitomizes the ecstatic news category. Also, of course, due to the dark twist in this case, which emerged after the week that we focused on in our data. So just a kind of a very brief kind of account of the story. Initially, reports claimed that the young married woman was strangled on May 11, 2021 by armed burglars who had invaded the couple's home in Glykana. According to these accounts provided by the testimonies of the husband, the assailants tied him up and murdered Caroline in front of their infant daughter. This narrative dominated the early news coverage as authorities launched an investigation into the incident, until it was later revealed that the perpetrator was, in fact, the husband, earlier portrayed as a grieving widower, who had staged what he thought was the perfect murder. As in emergency news, this category also mixes and fuses all. I think it's the previous one. All five frames. But what dominates now is not the interventionist frame, but the cinematic and witnessing frames. The former, the cinematic frame, operates in two ways. Firstly, it transforms the femicide into a public spectacle of a crime thriller, blending dramatic detail, suspense-driven timeline, and continuous repetition. At the same time, it construes an over-romanticized image of Caroline's middle-class family life in an ideal marriage with a quote-unquote young, handsome husband in a privileged profession. In other words, another cinematic element of it beyond the crime thriller is the fairy tale turned horror. Now,
We have to, sorry to interrupt. I think you have about 1 minute so that we can, yeah,
While
so the
the
words.
latter witnessing encompasses multiple voices that speak of the victim, such as family and friends, but also portray her as a full person and humanizes the victim for an extended period of time as a woman with a full name whose life was unfairly and tragically cut prematurely. This form of humanization is really impossible to have in either emergency or adventure news and offers a kind of biographical, emotional depth to the victim that it is really quite rare to see in any kind of news. So, just to summarize now, so here is the kind of we're not there yet. Yeah, we're there. In this presentation, we discussed preliminary results of an ongoing new study on femicides on Greek media and news press, still in its early stages. We specifically focused on the narrative analysis of the mediation of femicides in two popular newspapers, Efsin and Kathimerini, in 2021. Our focus has been on the variation of news frames as we wanted to complement existing research on the media construction of female victim and male perpetrator, giving insights into how such variation in the news frames categorize femicide victims into a hierarchy of worthy and unworthy lives. We identified five frames, from bureaucratic to interventionist, and argued that the hierarchy of victimhood depends on how these frames come together into concrete news categories: adventure news, emergency news, and ecstatic news. This hierarchy of victimhood that emerges from this analysis is as follows, and here comes our next and final slide. Certain lives, such as those of Caroline Crouch and Garifaleia Psaraku, become widely publicized as memorable lives, fitting the narrative of the perfect victim through their youth and personal attributes as mothers or promising professionals. In contrast, grievable lives, such as the victims from Akrinitsa, Daphne, Rhodes, and Alexandroupolis, have their humanity only partially acknowledged. These women, also young, typically aged from 28 to 32, are recognized as mothers of young children and as professionals, but the prominence of the interventionist frame places emphasis on institutional failures and anticipatory action rather than on the women's own lives. At the other end of the spectrum, in adventure stories, we have ungrievable lives where victims, who we know very little about, are reduced to mere statistics and rendered anonymous and invisible in the news. While our findings certainly point to age and class, I would say, as a significant dimension of both emergency and ecstatic news on femicide, and this certainly reflects an ageist bias, and a general preference for societal norms of youth, beauty, and motherhood in our mediated society, and that's already been established in research, we need to end with a word of caution. And if I can have another half a minute for this word of caution. This focus on young female victims does not mean that other sociological categories do not matter in the hierarchization of female victimhood in femicides. In fact, if we zoom out to our broader study, preliminary results show that in the course of the 4 years, 2020 to 2024, 25% of femicides recorded in the Greek Observatory for Femicides, which we used as a basis for our project, were not reported at all in any of the newspapers we analyzed. This invisibility is a form of institutional ignorance, which rests upon and reproduces a broader range of socioeconomic hierarchies within which women's lives are embedded. This is also the key takeaway from our analysis of adventure news. Its lack of references to any relevant context for the female victim, combined with the established fact that the majority of femicide victims come from low socioeconomic backgrounds, as Maria Liapi just mentioned earlier, and our preliminary data also suggest, also operates as a form of systemic ignorance. Here, Greek news decontextualized the majority of victims from their cultural and socioeconomic environments, that is, from the context that make the violence against them possible in the first place and eventually led to their death. And my final sentence, and yeah, that it's difficult to engage with the broader circumstances of femicide, to find ways to engage our public narrative, to change our public narratives about patriarchal violence, and to view all women as persons with emotional and psychological depth, as full human beings. Thank you. And apologies.
Thank you, Lily. Thank you, Lily, and thank you very much for your contributions. I think we have to move to the third one by Professor Podry.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And it's such a pleasure to be here and to be invited to contribute to this discussion. And I could see so many really important and interesting parallels. We've been thinking a bit more about the problem of matricide as not having visibility, but actually, even when things are reported, seeing the kind of nuance there in the cases is really, really fascinating. I'm just going to share my screen. Are you seeing two?
Yes,
Two.
not really. Thank you.
There we go. That's better. Okay, great. I'm going to be talking a little bit about femicide and matricide in the UK. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our work about the killing of mothers in the UK, which is an incredibly hidden problem.
Sorry to stop you, Rachel. You can make it actually full view. You had it in a minute ago. If you do the slide view, then because now we can also.
I thought I'd just change that. Sorry.
Yes, no worries. Thank
Is
you.
that better?
Yes, great.
Perfect. Sorry, I changed it around. Right, great, brilliant. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about femicide in the UK. I'm going to say a little bit about statistics and about figures. This is just to re-emphasize, I think, the point about the scale of femicide. So looking just at a single year in 2023, the UN Women report estimates that there were 51,000 women killed. And that was 140 women and girls every day on average in 2023 across the world. And if we look at the third image, we can see that that varies quite a bit by region. And one of the things with regions is that if we look in the lower part of that image per 100,000 population, we can see that the numbers shift around a bit in terms of the relative proportions. And I think that's really quite interesting in looking at the statistics in Greece, because thinking about the numbers that you've been talking about, when we first hear them, they don't necessarily sound quite as big as they are until we realize per 100,000 of population the size of those figures. So we've been doing some work with the UK Femicide Census, and the Femicide Census is amazing and a really amazing resource that collates information on all femicides in the UK and has been doing that back to 2009. They collate all different sources of information from things like news reports, from formal reviews, to kind of legal statistics and cases and all sorts of things in this huge database. And so it's a really, really comprehensive source of information. And just quoting from them here, they say that men's violence against women is a leading cause of the premature death for women globally. But research in the UK and Europe is limited and unconnected. And the Femicide Census significantly improves on this. It collects this data going back to 2009, including things like demographic and social factors and the methods that men use to kill women. And by collating femicides, and this is the important point that I wanted to make, we can see that these killings are not isolated incidents and many follow repeated patterns. And one of the things I think that's really important about the category of femicide, and I was hearing that also in Maria's presentation earlier on, is thinking about those connections, thinking about the connections between men killing women. So it's not necessarily even needing, there are many debates around this, of course, but whether or not we need the kind of legal category, but we absolutely need to be collating and counting this data and looking at it. So very kind of current news, the Femicide Census has published a report that was just published exactly a week ago. It was launched exactly a week ago. And in that report, they have now been able to analyse 2,000 cases of femicides going back to 2009. So one woman is killed by a man in the UK on average every 3 days, and 1,992 men were convicted of killing or otherwise found responsible for the death of these 2,000 women. And you can find that report in full on the Femicide Census website. So some of their findings, just to give you a kind of quick overview. So the majority of women killed by men were aged between 20 and 60, 73% of the sample. Only 5% were teenagers, but 22% were age 60 or over. The age of a victim affects who is most likely to be her killer, which is very telling and certainly relevant to the work that we are doing. You can see that there were 37 women who were killed alongside 53 children, most commonly by the father of the children, most killed in their own homes. Children witnessed at least 162 of the femicides. There were one of the crucial things was that mental ill health was a factor in 58% of the cases where sons killed their mother. And one of the things that really came through from this data, being able to look across time, is that one in nine cases of all of the femicides were mothers killed by their sons. So we're doing a piece of work at the moment, and this is current work, but I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the findings from this, but also look back to previous articles that we've published, one particularly about parricide, and one which is the killing of either parents or both parents, and one particularly about matricide, which is the killing of mothers, of course. So in this work, our previous work, we really found that there was a lack of in-depth research, specifically exploring the context and nuances and the lived experiences of mothers who are killed by their sons. And so this work uses this femicide census data. And in our data set, going back over that time, we've included grandmothers in our data set because we see that as the kind of maternal role, and there are a lot of parallels and similarities. So we have all a total data set of 177, which is 156 mothers and 21 grandmothers in this 13-year period. There's an average of 14 matricides per year. So just to go a little bit faster through this, the data are supplemented with analysis of domestic homicide review reports. So in the UK, in England and Wales, there's a legal requirement to conduct a domestic homicide review. So on any homicide that's deemed to be domestic, and there's various definitions, but within kin relationships or within a home, a review has to be conducted. So whichever local area it happened in, a chair is commissioned, and the chair appoints a panel, and that panel across time talks to all of the people where lessons could be learned. That can include and should include families where possible, but it also includes think people like various professionals, mental health professionals, police, looking at lessons that could be learned. So there's now quite a database of these, and actually in very recent times, just in the last year or so, the Home Office, the government, have created a library of them. So they're actually available as a resource. So if anyone's interested in that it's the Home Office and their domestic homicide review library. So you can go and find these and look under, you can search under particular categories. And they give us really quite in-depth contextual information, which is very interesting for us to be able to learn more about that. So we about 40% of our matricide cases had domestic homicide reviews. One of the crucial things that we found when we started to look in even more depth is that 141 out of the 177 perpetrators in these cases had a mental illness. That was about 70% in our data once we started to look much more deeply. And if you added in problematic substance use, that's almost at 80%, 79.6%. So there's compelling evidence that these are really important problems here. And when we're talking about mental illness, we're talking about very severe mental illness that's causing drastic changes in behavior. Often the most common is something like schizophrenia, or other kind of delusional disorders. And you know, it's important to acknowledge that most people with mental illness are not dangerous to other people, but there is a small subsection of people where their behavior is really dangerous to themselves or to other people. But that risk, and the crucial thing that we're going to be talking about, because of the lack of recognition of violence towards mothers from adult children or adult sons, we haven't seen, we've seen very, very little recognition of this and very, very little action around it. So, key themes from our work on matricide. I think the first one keys in really nicely with this particular project. We found a concept from Purdy Vaughan's and Ibach of
intersectional invisibility. This was used in a different context, but this is about an invisibility that's rooted in structures of inequality. And in our article on matricide, we write about this being about the marginalization of older women. These are often middle-aged and elderly women who are killed, but also the marginalization of mothers and of carers as well, that kind of invisibility of them. And I think, you know, that really came through in some of the things that you were talking about before, about how, you know, certain cases are just not really seen. And that's absolutely the case here. A huge failure to understand risk to mothers. We've seen this across all of the work that we've done, a failure to identify or recognise domestic abuse that's son to mother, a failure to recognise the risk from the symptoms of things like schizophrenia and psychosis. But crucially, mothers were also, and we use this phrase, marginalized and responsabilized in their son's treatment. So responsabilized in the sense that they were expected to make sure they got to appointments on time or to make sure they took their medication, but often they were really the primary carer for this son, somebody with very severe mental illness, needs quite a lot of support often to function in life. And often they were also living together. So we saw all of these characteristics. On the one hand, mothers were being expected to do this, and on the other hand, there were huge decisions being taken about what happened with the sons, without including the mothers, or the mothers were, you know, big decisions were taken, or sometimes they had said that they were fearful about their son, but nobody had ever stopped to ask. One of the things that really struck us as a great example of this was that one of the sons had written in his medical notes that he should never be left alone with female staff. And yet nobody had asked whether or not he should be living alone with his mother, and she was sadly killed. So this is a very important theme, we think. Also a theme of what we call parental proximity. Basically, to summarise that more quickly, high levels of kind of caring relationships, the son often living in the home, and the mother doing this kind of broadly defined caring here. There were some cases as well where very severely mentally ill sons were caring for very elderly or frail mothers. Some of the cases were there. But in all these cases, they were kind of very much enmeshed in each other's lives, and also very isolated, often alone and without any support. I think we use the phrase in one of our articles that these mothers were often the kind of last woman standing, when services and other people and friends and family over the years had dropped away, and expecting mothers to assess and see, to be able to kind of identify the risk that they're under is just unfair, because mothers are unlikely to be able to judge that or judge whether or not it's become more severe, not least because they have probably been going through this escalating to a various degree for some 40, 50 years. And so leaving that responsibility with mothers, we argue, is incredibly unfair. Very high rates of mental illness, as I've mentioned, and also with trying to counter this invisibility, a real need to understand the lived experiences of mothers who are living with abuse, in fear of violence, but this kind of everydayness that the term of slow femicide has been used before, of mothers living in a situation where they're experiencing violence and risky situations over many, many years, but just really invisible. And then again, insights are there around this. Sometimes there are, you know, a few pieces of work about the difficulty of caring for a severely mentally ill adult child in the literature within psychiatry, but within other fields, very hidden. And we argue in here that women killed by their sons are victims of femicide. You might think that's kind of not in question, but actually one of the strange things about the killing of parents is that it is roughly equally mothers and fathers who are killed. But what we found in our research is that the circumstances of these are very, very different. And so they need to be analysed and seen as separate problems. And there are many parallels with the killing of women as mothers with other forms of the killing of women. So we argue that women are killed by men because they're women as mothers in their gendered roles as neglected and isolated carers, and because of an institutionalised state failure to protect them as vulnerable citizens. So just a case study to show you, and apologies that this is quite detailed, but here this woman was killed by her 44-year-old son He was severely mentally ill. He was found wandering the streets naked after the killing. He thought that his mother was a witch, and she was found on a bed in her home where he was living temporarily. He had been diagnosed with schizophrenia since the age of 18, but he'd stopped taking his medication some weeks before the homicide. But importantly, major decisions had been made about his treatment, including not consulting his mother about a decision to allow him to stop his medication. And yet she was expected to monitor his condition and report any problems. And he pled, we won't have time to talk about legal outcomes, but a legal plea of diminished responsibility. Some services knew that he'd previously been violent towards his mother, and there had been a safeguarding alert made after a call to an with an ambulance, and but that wasn't appropriately acted on, and so it progressed sadly to homicide. So when we think about questions of representation, thinking this through, on the left here are some of the faces of mothers who've been killed and their sons. And we don't see these faces very often in the newspapers. And actually, the Guardian newspaper has had a concerted effort to cover femicide quite a bit in the last sort of 2 or 3 years. And they're trying to name all of the cases and make sure that the women who are killed are named. And that's resulted in some coverage that I'll mention briefly shortly. And this picture on the left I've taken from there, but these are not familiar faces for us. What are familiar, and this resonates very much with the project here, are cases like Sarah Everard. And Sarah Everard is the one in the picture there with the photos behind her of campaigns, and her case generated in the UK a huge movement around violence against women and various protests against the police and so on. But Sarah Everard, this was also interestingly in 2021, but you can see many characteristics for yourself if you look at the case that resonates so strongly. She's a attractive, white, professional woman, middle class. It was a stranger killing. Also, the killing was done by a police officer. She was walking home. She was essentially, in the construction of it, couldn't have been more blameless, if you like. None of it was being kind of attributed to her, none of the stigma of having been in a domestically abusive relationship and so on. When it comes to cases of parricide, so the killing of parents, there are two cases here. One of them everybody's familiar with, particularly at the moment because of the more recent series on Netflix, but the Menendez brothers in the US who shot their parents in what was thought to be, there are elements of abuse being talked about now, but thought to be very much around finances and money, and is so uncharacteristic of so many of the parricides. A financial motive is very rare. Two children killing two parents is very rare. In the UK, using guns is very rare. You can see that these are not the kind of common cases that receive publicity. Now, there were lots of other reasons around that case. But also, I was involved in some of the kind of coverage and publicity around this case at the bottom. Some of you may have seen on social media. This is Virginia McCulloch. Just in the past year, this took place. She killed both her parents, but she hid their bodies in the house. And the police were wearing body-worn cameras when they went to arrest her. And so there was footage of her arrest and what she said to the police officers and so on. And so that generated just an enormous amount of coverage, endless newspapers coverage. But we looked back to see if we could find another example of a female perpetrated double parricide in the UK. And we couldn't find one. So not only a double power, they're just incredibly, incredibly rare. But yet these are the cases that receive coverage. So I was interested to look about matricides in Greece, and you'll have to excuse my very poor research. I don't speak Greek, but I did find two articles here, one from 2022 about two sons killing their mothers, and then another one about an elderly man killing his mother in 2023. So I would be, you know, really interested to know more about how matricide, the killing of mothers, are presented. I'm not sure about the validity of these new sources, but I note they have the same police car as one of the articles that was there before. So they probably fit quite well. So just to mention some coverage that's very recent. I'm just checking the time. Okay, I'll one or two more minutes and I'll be done. So the Guardian's attempt to really publicise this is so interesting, and it's the only attempt, and it really stands out because of that. So just a week ago, when the femicide census report came out, the Guardian had a whole series of articles, and they actually chose to focus on the matricide work. And the image on the left is not to show you Meghan Markle, but to the bottom of that page, it's the front page of the paper version of the, and they covered our work. They interviewed us and covered our work there, and the headline at the bottom on the front page of the Guardian is that mothers killed by sons and 9% of femicide cases. And then there were two more kind of articles within the paper, like expanding on it and everything. And in this second one, they used a quote from me: "I'm becoming more fired up about the injustice of this, and I was glad that they'd called it the real injustice." But it's so interesting to see that this has suddenly been written about. Having said that, in terms of coverage, I was on standby to be on The World at One on Radio 4 at lunchtime to talk about it. And the case was knocked off as I literally just joined the Zoom link to talk, to be interviewed. The case was knocked off because of that awful case, multiple rape case the student was found guilty of, the PhD student at UCL who raped a lot of women. He was just found guilty at that point. And it seems that there isn't room within an hour news bulletin or so for more than one story about violence against women. So this was the story that got knocked out. So it's just some further reading if anyone wants to pursue that. The Guardian has those various articles, and one where they also covered this issue back in 2023. But both of our articles in the journal Violence Against Women and in the journal Current Sociology are open access. And please do get in touch if you have trouble getting hold of any of these. I'd be very happy to share them. And just to end now, sorry, the light has suddenly shone very brightly on me. We found this quotation in terms of the consequences of invisibility and the consequences of not being covered. And I think this keys in so nicely to your concluding points there, Lily, that here we found this book from 1981. And in that book, the author concluded that it looked at 58 male matricide patients in Broadmoor Secure Hospital. And he said that many of the matricides could have been averted by closer psychiatric supervision and care. And yet in all of those years, there has never been a prevention policy. There has never been any government or local policy to try to prevent matricides or try to assess risk from sons towards mothers. And now we know, just going back to 2009, that we have over 170 deaths. If we go back to 1981, I haven't done the maths yet, but we can see that we will have so many more. And I think it's astonishing that there's no coverage, no response, no naming of the problem, apart from this very recent coverage in the Guardian. And I think it keys in really very much to thinking about exactly in your points in this study, which cases are memorable, which cases are grievable. And I'm, you know, quite fascinated why these mothers have been missing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Because, I mean, horror stories and... But thank you for sharing all this with us. So I think we can now go back to, you know, all panel members. Maybe we can have a gallery view. I'll leave this to, anyway, maybe I could have a gallery. Okay, I do have a gallery view of everyone. And my apologies for my technical problems before. So we have actually questions, and because we don't have so much time, I'm gonna go straight to the questions rather than giving time to the panel members to reflect to each other's presentations. So the first question is from Tiago Conceio from the University of Aveiro, who has a question about the Lilis and the Aphrodite's talk. They found the frames interesting, and they say, I'm curious to know whether in any of the cases that you analyzed, there wasn't any information for support lines, NGOs available for potential victims. In a way, this could even contribute to the idea of this crime as preventable. So, Lily or Aphrodite, would you like to take this question?
I didn't hear the question very clearly. I'm sorry. Aphrodite, did you?
Yeah, I can take the question if that's okay. Thank you for the question. I think this is a very important question that links back to the limited information that we could actually find in them in the different news stories, with the majority of them being the adventure news when there was limited information. So when the news stories actually relied on police and forensic reports. So unfortunately, there was limited information that directed victims of gender-based violence to different NGOs or to any kind of institutional support, I'm afraid.
Thank you for the tea. Lily, is there anything you would like to add to this? I think you can also see the Q&A questions. Maybe I will move on to the next one, and then if there is time.
I think this week, yeah, we have a few minutes.
Yeah, no worries. Okay, so we have another question from Federica Formato, senior lecturer University of Brighton, I believe. The question is, I mean, they're doing similar work in Italy. They are happy to share. And the question is femicide in Greece discussed in mainstream media as a political institutional topic outside of the reporting of specific femicides? From my experience, I found the Italian public debate much stronger and louder than in UK media. Now, maybe Maria would like to take this or any of the... Maria, would you be interested to answer this question? Or Lily or Fuditi, or I wouldn't ask Rachel because about the Greek media.
Well, I mean, someone who lives in Greece and is part of the public sphere, I think would be more appropriate to respond to that.
That's why I thought Maria might want to take that one.
I mean, perhaps what we could say is that there is definitely a change in the discourse since 2021. We can see it, first of all, in the increased use of the word femicide in some parts of the press, particularly left-wing press, even though that has not yet become legal terminology. It is nonetheless a much more widespread language to use in the public sphere, and I think the press has played a role in that. And with that, I do believe that the whole question of gender-based violence and the killing of women has become a much more prominent topic, and that it is discussed openly in a way that I did not remember in previous years in Greece. I think beyond measuring whether the debate is there, which we can and we haven't, it has not been the focus of our study, at least so far, maybe it will become. I think another question that's really important is what is the quality of that conversation? Who participates? Who has a voice? What are the dominant arguments? And who shapes the parameters of what we talk about and what we don't? I think there is a very robust feminist activist network in Greece that does really important kind of grassroots work in changing, you know, both the language, the mentality and practices with respect to gender relations and with respect to gender violence policies and measures. But I do think that mainstream media are still dominated very much by patriarchal structures of representation. Those who have the voice are really not those people who understand in depth or have the lived experience or really have any real political stake in changing this situation. So I think beyond whether that discussion is taking place, I think another important question is what is the quality of that debate, and I think we need to do much more in order to both, you know, kind of broaden and deepen and nuance the conversations that are taking place.
Thank you, Lily. I think, you know, we have one more minute, and I'm afraid that they're going to cut us all, and it's not going to be because of. So I would like to thank you all very much for your contributions. I think, you know, also for working on this very, very hot topic, and I believe that so we need to have another event in person next time because I think it would be much better to communicate all these kind of issues when we can see each other. So thank you all very much for being here. And I'm sorry for those questions that they cannot be answered. Please email the speakers, I believe, you know, if you want to have their references. Some people ask for your references, or if you want to continue the discussion. So have all a very nice evening, and thank you very much for participating in this event.